Hello and welcome to the Free Movement Immigration Update podcast. My name is Colin Yeo and I am joined by Sonia Lenigan, who for next month is planning to do this introduction and take over, or at least I'm planning that she takes over and does the introduction from next month. But she's got so much on her plate right now that I'm doing this month. We are covering a few things here for July 2023. Just have a quick look at the running order to tell you what we've got. Not one, but two statements of changes. Got a few asylum things, OSC update, some EU law things, a few immigration updates, including the fees, which is the thing that, you know, all the shitty things this government, excuse my language, but all the rubbish things the government has done over the last however many months. This is the single thing I think that's upset me the most. And then we've got a bunch of cases to run through at the end, covering all sorts of things. We're not covering all of the material from July 2023, because it turns out there was an awful lot of it. But we're covering the stuff that we think is kind of has most ongoing relevance to immigration lawyers and practitioners. If you want to claim CPD points for reading the material and listening to podcasts, then head over to freemovement.org.uk/training and sign up as a Free Movement member, where we've got tons and tons of training materials available for lawyers who need to prove to their regulator that they're keeping themselves up to date. Sonia, you haven't actually said hello, and I'm launching into the next item. So just to prove you're here, say something.
Hi, everyone. I'm here. Technically, I was not in post in July, so I think it's fine that you're still doing this one. But yes, prepare for chaos next month onwards. I do find it very amusing that you are the only person who has sworn in this podcast to date. Anyone who knows me in real life will also find that quite a fun fact.
Well, maybe that's something that we've got coming up for listeners in future then.
I'll get the bleep button ready.
Get your immigration updates and also swearing from us in future. Okay, so I'm going to start with the statement of changes. There were two of these, not just one. One of them was basically a no notice and very short change. And we're actually recording this on Thursday, the 7th of September. And Sonia's waiting with bated breath for another, what we suspect to be similar statement of changes to be announced later today, which we'll write up as soon as we can. So this one was HC 1715, and all it did was add Dominica, Honduras, Namibia, and Timor-Leste, and Vanuatu. I don't know how you pronounce that, actually, but one of the...
Vanuatu.
Thank you, Sonia. One of the Pacific Islands, basically, to the list of countries whose nationals require a visa to travel to the UK. For Vanuatu. Dominica and...
Yes, sorry, can you help me?
It's about their golden passport schemes, basically. So other, you know, other nationalities were buying their citizenship and then using visa-free travel to come to the UK. For Honduras and Namibia, it was about rising numbers of asylum claims. And for the Timorese, it was about alleged fraudulent use of the EU settlement scheme. So we'll move on from that. The big statement of changes was HC 1496, and this had a whole load of different stuff in it. I'm going to start with the asylum and humanitarian protection. And the first big change, which I'm going to bring Sonia in a moment on, is that the circumstances in which an asylum claim is treated as withdrawn have been widened. Now, Sonia, do you want to just, you've been all over this right from the start and sort of alerting people to it. Do you want to just sort of talk through roughly what happened and what the significance is?
Yes. I mean, basically, this is something that I have been banging on about for a while now. There was a National Order Office report, I think in April maybe, that sort of flagged up that a lot of claims have been withdrawn. And then, you know, when I was still in my previous role, we were asking the Home Office about this, and the lack of answers was concerning. And I'll talk more about it in the August Roundup podcast, because I did quite a long article about whether or not what they're doing is lawful or not. But we did publish a briefing in July, which is just goes through why and how is the Home Office treating more asylum claims as withdrawn. And that specifically addresses the expansion of the rules in this statement of changes, which allow the Home Office to do more implicit withdrawals, which is basically for things like missing an interview or not returning a questionnaire, things like that. So yes, as I said, we will cover that more in the next podcast. So I'm not going to go into more detail about that now.
And listeners will be able to catch up on that fairly soon, because we're sort of after the summer. We've both been very rarely in the country near a microphone at the same time. So we're a bit behind, but we're catching up rapidly, and we'll have the August roundup out in the next week or two. Yeah, the withdrawal pieces we've covered. So I was looking for somebody to commission to cover this when we saw that there was that sharp increase in the stats, and Nadia Amara at Garden Court Chambers did that initial piece. And then just before we were ready to publish it, they suddenly changed the rules. So we had to go in and kind of add that in. So we've been trying to sort of keep people aware of what's going on, having spotted something in the stats fairly early on. Now, back to the status changes. So this is HC1496. The other big asylum change, which was a good one, was basically getting rid of the differentiation between Group 1 and Group 2 refugees, which was the centerpiece of the, I've even forgotten what it's called, the Nationality and Borders Act 2022, which is kind of effectively dead and buried mainly. And the one really poisonous legacy of it is the criminalization of arrivals. But yeah, the sort of centerpiece differentiation policy was basically dropped. So refugees are back to all getting 5 years of leave. And the handful of refugees who were granted 10 years are having that basically retrospectively changed. So they're going to get 5 years instead. There are a few changes to the EU settlement scheme as well. We've got the High Court, quite a long time ago, finding that, I'm going to sum this up in a way that probably isn't quite accurate, but is concise, should we say, basically held that it was unlawful to require people to apply twice to the settlement scheme. So if you got pre-settled status, it was unlawful to require you to have to make another application to sort of retain lawful status. And eventually the Home Office got round to changing the rules a bit, gave themselves a discretion to extend leave, which is slightly worrying because the terms of the High Court judgment were really that they had to. But it's been accompanied by announcements that they sound like they're going to follow through on that for basically everybody. So from September, 2 year extensions are automatically going to be granted to people whose leave is expiring. And also they've announced that they have plans in 2024 to start automatically upgrading people with pre-settled status if their sort of algorithm checks of government records indicate that they qualify. So they do have 5 years continuous leave. We don't know how that's going to work. I think legal advice from a sort of conservative lawyer who thinks about, what's the worst case scenario point of view would be, you should probably just apply for settlement anyway, rather than wait for some sort of automated system to automatically upgrade you at some point in the future. But this looks like a positive step by the Home Office, at least. Also some less good changes. So the Home Office has moved the reasons for a late application to the validity section of the rules, which means that if your application, which was made late, gets refused, you do not have a right of administrative review or appeal. You're going to have to judicially review or give up, basically. And some less good changes on joining family members who, if they are an illegal entrant as legally defined, no longer qualify. Positive change to the definition of dependent relatives, so that the adult child of a durable partner can qualify. And unfortunately, the Surinder Singh and Zambrano routes are closed as of the 8th of August 2023. So quick changes to the student rules, which were fairly sort of heavily trailed beforehand about reducing the number of students who can be accompanied by family members. Some changes to the shortage occupation list. Ukraine scheme has been extended. A tweak to the adult dependent relative rules. Now, this is a good change because it's basically there was an accidental update to the rules that made it even harder to qualify than it was previous. It wasn't deliberate. I think the Home Office wasn't, as I understand it, applying that new approach because it had been accidental, and they've just formally changed the rules back to how they meant it to be all along. So that's a sort of positive change to the rules, but it's not really a change in on the ground policy, so to speak. Right, good grief. That was quite a lot in a short space of time. So that's statement changes, and now it gets even worse. And I'm going to hand over to Sonia to try and explain what's going on with the Illegal Migration Act.
Okay, please read my article. Lots of people have, and they all said it's great and very useful. So I really just recommend going and reading it if you work in the sector at all, which is why you're listening to this podcast. Essentially, I see a lot of people talking about the Illegal Migration Act as though it is all currently in force, and as though the duty to remove does exist currently and people are at risk of being detained under the Act. None of that is the case currently. Very, very little of the Act has actually been brought into force at the moment. I remain highly sceptical about the rest of it ever being brought into force because it is so unworkable. However, we'll have to wait and see. So the little bit that is important, that is in force, is around Section 30, which prohibits a grant of entry clearance, an electronic travel authority, or leave to enter or remain to anyone who has arrived in the UK on or after the 7th of March and who meets the conditions set out in Section 2. I'm not going to go through all of that. We still don't have guidance on how it would work for these people. So yeah, it's all still pretty unclear. I understand that guidance is forthcoming at some point about what will happen to people in that situation, as in who are coming here, who are refugees, but who are apparently prohibited under Section 30 from being granted leave to remain. So yeah, essentially, very little has changed. What has changed, it's still not entirely clear what is going to happen. But yeah, read my article, and obviously we will keep everyone updated once the guidance is published and we have a bit more clarity, and obviously if and when more of the Act is actually brought into force. What I would just point out is that a lot can change with implementation. We saw that with the Nationality and Borders Act. So I really don't see too much point in worrying about the vast majority of the Legal Migration Act at this point in time. Colin, you even said in your latest Substack that you thought campaigners could ignore it. And I agree. I think lawyers largely can do the same.
Well, that's sort of, yeah, that's sort of optimistic, isn't it? Although, you know, at some point, presumably, it comes, who knows? One of the things that I'm going to really put you on the spot here. I'm sorry, Sonia. One of the things that really struck me about your piece is that you say that one of the bits has been commenced so that anyone who's arrived since the 7th of March can't now be granted refugee leave, but their claim can be considered. What the hell's going to happen to them?
Well, exactly.
That doesn't make any sense.
And yeah, when I was talking to John Featenby about this article, hopefully he won't mind that I mention him. And, you know, he said, I think you're the first person to think about this, Sonia. So I have no idea what the plan is, whether anyone had thought it through properly, because it does seem functionally insane. I'm just really, really keen to see this guidance and to see how they're going to try and square this circle, because, you know, this seems unworkable. Potentially, the plan was more of a ban on re-entry and a ban on, I think, citizenship as well. I don't know if the extent to which anyone had actually considered leave to remain been impossible under the immigration rules. As I said in the article, I think potentially some sort of discretionary leave outside the rules. I mean, these people are going to have to be granted something. So someone in the Home Office is either in the process of or has sorted out a plan, which we will be notified of at some point rather soon, one hopes.
Well,
look, I didn't write the thing, Colin. I don't think any of it makes sense. I'm just explaining to you how I best understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it is just, it's completely and utterly poorly thought through. Yeah, who knows? I mean, honestly, this whole thing is completely ridiculous, not least the fact that they, you know, apparently felt the need to keep the House of Lords up until 3 a.m. or whatever it was to get this passed before recess. And now they're doing very, very little with it.
Yeah. All right. On that note, let's move on. I think you're actually, the next item is yours as well, which is on safe and legal routes.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail. It was just basically a roundup of what safe and legal routes are available for people to come to the UK. Obviously, just to sort of push back on this whole argument that people should be going and joining the queue and people who just turn up under their own steam are doing the wrong thing. Actually, safe and legal routes are extremely limited, very difficult to access. And, you know, I noticed that the government does, whenever they talk about the people who have come via safe and legal routes, they always start that period from 2015. And, you know, in recent years, the numbers have been dramatically lower than they were back then.
That's sort of true and sort of not, though, isn't it? Because, the number of people
who've entered... We're going to have our usual argument.
The number of people who've entered from Ukraine is huge. And the number of people who've entered from Hong Kong, again, is huge. It's just that it's very limited to just those countries, though. For anybody else, it's really impossible.
You know, they're not granted refugee status. And for Ukrainians, it's problematic. They do not have a path to settlement. I'm always happy to have the argument with you about whether they count. I mean, obviously they do to an extent, but the fact that they haven't been granted refugee status and that they are left in that state of limbo, I think, is highly unsatisfactory.
Yeah, no, absolutely agreed. And it'd be interesting to see what happens at the end of that scheme, you know, if or when the war does finally end, because the precedent in the 90s with the sort of Yugoslav crisis and collapse and the wars there was that people were expected to return. But I think we were talking about considerably smaller numbers and also sort of staged return, because there's different, new countries settled down a bit and the wars ended in different places, or different cohorts were then expected to return. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens with that. Okay, I've got a sort of rather mundane in comparison one to cover, which is an OIC update on judicial review, basically for regulated advisors. Essentially, they had seemingly widened the circumstances in which OISC advisors who've got this special authorization to engage in judicial review work, what they're allowed to do in terms of litigation. And the OISC has rowed back from that and saying, actually, we're going to have to withdraw that part of the practice note because of this other case in an unrelated area of law. So it's very important if you're involved in OISC work and judicial review work. It's of absolutely no interest to anybody else. So there you go. That's done, and we can move on to the next one, which is a much more widely significant one. Although I suppose it is only a relatively sort of, again, narrow cohort of people it affects, but it affects them in a really profound way. So this is the a new Nationality Act that was passed during 2023, which some of you probably would be surprised to hear about. It's the British Nationality (brackets) Regularisation of Past Practice (brackets) Act 2023, and it came into force on the 29th of June. It is very short. It inserts a new Section 50B into the 1981 Act, and it basically confirms what the Home Office said and thought the law was previously for the British nationality status of children born between the 1st of January 1983 and the 1st of October 2000 to an EU citizen parent who was exercising free movement rights in the UK, where the child has no other claim to British citizenship. Now, that's narrow, but it's actually probably quite a lot of people, in fact. So if, for example, the other parent was British, or if the other parent had ILR, then potentially the child would have been British anyway. But because of this litigation that's been going through the courts called RORIG, there was some doubt, well, a lot of doubt, about the status of those children. The RORIG case carries on. There's a Court of Appeal hearing coming up, we think, on that. But irrespective of the outcome of RORIG, the nationality status of those children is secured by this positive piece of nationality legislation. And Sonia, I think it's now over to you for absence from the UK under the EU settlement scheme.
Yeah, so this article, how does absence from the UK work under the EU settlement scheme? This is important, particularly in the context of COVID, obviously, which had an impact for a lot of people on absences from the UK. So this article explains how absences can impact the ability to get settled status under the EU settlement scheme, and it also covers permitted absences after settled status has been granted. So if this is something you're concerned about at all, then that is the article to look at. I'm going to move on to the next one, which is a glitch or a feature, systemic problems with digital proof of immigration status. So this one explains why digital-only proof is problematic, which many of us will already be aware of. But it looks at five different ways the system is glitching currently, which I think is quite interesting to go through. Obviously, at the moment, this only affects EU citizens, but the intention is still to roll it out more widely. So this is an issue that is not going to go away. It is just going to get more and more serious. I would also draw your attention to, there's a link in the article to the 3 Millions Report It tool. I do see them tweet fairly often when there are issues with people using their digital status. So I would just say that if you do encounter any errors, please do use that tool, because obviously that is important evidence collection, as well as them sharing information with everyone else when these issues arise.
So I thought this was a really fascinating article. I asked Kuba to write it ages ago and had to chase him a couple of times, I think it would be fair to say, to get him to do it. And the thing that I found really interesting about it, apart from the problems, it is the cause of the problems. One of the root causes is that people don't have, there's no document anywhere. There's no database entry. There's no thing that says what your status is. And every time your status doesn't exist as such, and it's all that happens is that every time it's checked, you get this kind of return from a search on various different databases that will say what they think your status is at any given moment. So it's, there's no, and the way he puts it is there's no token to as proof of status that either that you have or that the government has. And it means that if the checks aren't working, the sort of multiple, you know, there's multiple different checks that are run simultaneously when they're checking your status, then yeah, you don't have a status basically as far as those checks are concerned. So it's yes, yeah, slightly different way of thinking about status. I think it's very interesting. Okay, over to something I swore about earlier, which is the massive increases to immigration fees. Now I think everybody will know about this now, so I suppose there's not too much point in rehearsing it. But they haven't actually been brought into force. I've seen different bits of speculation about when this is going to happen, but I guess I've been sort of not paying attention consistently through the summer. I think I've heard autumn, I've heard spring. Sonia, have you heard anything more concrete?
I think, now I can't remember which is which, but I think they're doing it in two lots. So it's the application fees going up either autumn or spring, and the immigration health surcharge, the other one. I think that is the plan, but do not take my word for it. I'm just as anxious on dates as everyone else.
Yeah,
is.
And obviously, as soon as we've got any kind of confirmation, we'll publish that on the blog. But basically, the immigration health surcharge is increasing from £624 per year to £1,035 per year for this main charge. The discounted rate for some is going up from 470 to 776. And there's also going to be a really substantial rise in immigration and nationality fees as well. So work and visit fees are expected to rise by 15%. And student visas, certificates of sponsorship, settlements, citizenship, entry clearance, leave to remain, basically everything else by at least 20%, they say. The reason I'm so upset about this, in part, is that, and I know some people are going to wonder what I'm saying here, but I don't think any incoming government can reverse this, because once this is kind of part of the Home Office budget, I don't think any incoming government, I'm talking about Labour government, would be able to simply say, oh, Treasury, we need more money so that we can cut fees for immigrants. I just don't think that could happen. I'd hope that they wouldn't have done this themselves, but I don't see them reversing it. And these fees are so punishing. They're so punishing. And, you know, they cause such disadvantage and discrimination to migrant families. So it's really very upsetting to see this happen. And I think I said this in the blog post. I kind of, again, a lot of people probably disagree with this. I don't really mind in principle if fairly high fees are charged to non-family for entry to the UK, because you can just choose to pay them or not at that point in time. You can go somewhere else, if you're a student or you're a skilled worker or whatever. And, you know, it's true that if we increase the fees to a certain extent, people won't want to come here. But, well, that's, you know, if that's the line that the government of the day takes, that's kind of up to migrants to choose what they want to do. But once you're already here, imposing those kinds of fees and then ratcheting them up just really punishes people for just living their lives in the UK and makes them very disadvantaged compared to comparable families. And yeah, there's no way they're going to leave. It's just a kind of extra tax on being an immigrant. So yeah, I found this, this affects so many people so perniciously, and it's so sort of wide ranging. This is one of the worst things I think the government's done for a very long time, and that's saying something. So pretty depressing stuff, basically. Sonia, you're you try and cheer us up with something else.
I don't know, that this is kind of a neutral post, I think. Briefing, the rules on returning residents with indefinite leave to remain. So this is an update of a previous post. We've been trying to go through and update quite a few of our older ones. And this briefing covers what to do if a person has lost their indefinite leave to remain but wishes to return to the UK. So it is extremely useful if you have someone in that situation. Obviously, there's different rules, whether you have leave under the EU settlement scheme or indefinite leave to remain under the other rules, but it's all in there. Very useful briefing. I am doing the next one as well, which is how to apply for a global business mobility secondment worker visa. This is for overseas workers who are seconded to the UK as part of a high-value contract or investment by their overseas employer. There are apparently only 4 sponsors who hold a license in this route, and Pip describes it as a last resort. But, I mean, someone is going to be making those applications for those 4 sponsors. And if that's you, then we've got you covered. Go and read this very useful how to apply guide. We're on to cases now. And so it's your turn, Colin.
So on to cases. We've got the first case we're going to cover is an important one in principle, but it doesn't have a huge impact on the ground because it kind of confirms the status quo. It's one from the Supreme Court called Maroof. A citation is 2023 UKSC 23. And the background to this is that the Syrian resettlement scheme, which began in 2015, basically relied, or the UK scheme, relied on UNHCR to select refugees for resettlement to the UK. One sort of side effect of that, and some might say it was deliberate, I suspect it was probably a side effect, was that it meant that any Palestinians in Syria couldn't benefit from that scheme because they weren't under UNHCR's mandate. They were under the mandate of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, as it's kind of awkwardly known. We've got quite a lot of coverage on the website these days about the legal status of Palestinian refugees. You can see links to briefings and so on that we've got there. Basically, it meant that I think it's over 500,000 Syrians who were registered with UNRWA in Syria couldn't qualify, which was obviously very unfortunate for them. It was obviously discriminatory, but the Supreme Court holds that the public sector equality duty probably didn't apply abroad in these circumstances. So not a good outcome, but it kind of confirmed the status quo in that sense. The next case, I think, is one that you're going to cover, Sonia, which is an asylum case.
Yeah, so this is, the article is called Asylum Seekers Don't Need Direct Evidence They're Being Covertly Monitored. The case is WAS Pakistan and Secretary of State for the Home Department. It's a Court of Appeal decision. It's actually the second Court of Appeal decision of the year where they have found that the upper tribunal has applied too high a standard of proof. And that was the main issue in this case. I think at some point we are going to start seeing these standard of proof cases run into trouble when they were made after the Nationality and Borders Act, because obviously that is where the standard of proof has been raised in primary legislation. It will probably take a while, though, before we start seeing decisions on that basis, not least because those post 28th of June 2022 cases have been deprioritized in favor of, I think they're calling it the legacy backlog.
Yeah, the legacy and flow or something. And they're sort of hiding what's going on with these kind of technical terms and so on is classic government tactic, isn't it? Okay, so I've got a couple of cases to cover, which is kind of, these are slightly funny ones. It's like going back in time and looking through sort of early copies of the sort of immigration law reports from the 1970s and so on. So there's 2 student cases about arrival in the UK. The first of these, that the blog post is, let me just check I've got these the right way around, is airport detainee wrongly denied a solicitor in immigration interview. And it's the case of Kumar, 2023 EWHC 1741 admin. He arrives at Manchester Airport with a student visa. The immigration officer ends up basically refusing him entry, and he is denied a solicitor, as we say in the blog post. And that is held to be basically unlawful. It was an unfair and fundamentally flawed process leading to the decision to refuse. So I thought that was quite an interesting one. It's something to watch out for. I've actually made an FOI request for the policy in question, and I'm not holding my breath whether I'll get it, but it seems to have been an unpublished policy about these things. So again, if that ever does come out, then we'll share it. The other case is minded to cancel process applies to dishonesty allegations at the UK border. And this is the other student case. It's called Tazim, 2023 EWHC 1828 admin. And this is another one on procedural fairness at the border. And basically, he gets refused entry. The immigration officer who interviews him is concerned that his English isn't good enough and refuses. And then at that point, basically alleges that there was a falsified test. That was never put to him, so he had no opportunity to respond. and the judge holds that that's unfair. So again, it's sort of interesting and potentially useful one. And I guess, you know, just that the increase in the number of not just students, but other migrants who are arriving and going through these kind of border processes means that there might well be more potential for litigation of this kind in future. So yeah, if you're interested in these issues, do take a look at those ones. I've got another kind of pairing of ones to go through now, looking at our list of who's doing what. And this is a couple of cases from the upper tribunal. These aren't exactly the most profound cases. The first one is entitled Upper Tribunal Reminds Parties to Identify the Issues in an Appeal. This TCPS Compliance Issues-Based Reasoning Zimbabwe 2023 UKUT 00164IAC. It's looking at kind of reformed FTT appeal procedure and the way that that works, and it's basically telling us things that I think we already know, that really that the tribunal ought to be, this isn't quite what they say, but the tribunal ought to be enforcing the Home Office to be a bit more engaged with the process. And the fact that they're not is causing problems in appeals. And yeah, I've just been moaning to Sonia off the podcast about a case that I've got coming up next week where I'm not sure whether to prep it, because I'm expecting that the Home Office presenting officer who actually is faced with presenting the appeal is going to concede it. And, you know, it means that I won't get paid for any of the prep that I've done prior to that concession coming through the day before the hearing, which has happened to me several times recently and is very, very irritating. The other one is called Tribunal Must Consider Home Office Decisions in Full, Even When Not Explicitly Relied On by the Representative. Again, I think it's kind of something we already knew. This is Shaiti, 2023 EWCA Civ 770. Sorry, it's an actually tribunal case. It's a Court of Appeal case, I should say, realizing from the citation there. You know, take a look. It's an interesting example of the upper tribunal being caught out by the Court of Appeal, something that does occasionally still happen, nowhere near as much as it used to. And we used to have a tag for tribunal overturned again on free movement, which I used a lot back in the early days. And that's just not something that happens anything like as much as it used to. So it's in semi-retirement. I think it might have been pulled out for one last mission on this one. Okay, Sonia, I think you are doing the next one. In fact, you're running through to the end of the podcast, in fact.
Yep, it's all me now. Right, first of all, High Court rejects challenge to EU settlement scheme dependency rules for children. This is a judicial review. The case is Ali and Secretary of State for the Home Department in the admin court. So this was a case where the applicant had previously held an EEA residence card as a non-EU national dependent child of an EU mother. When she applied under the EUSS, she was over 21 and estranged from her mother, so the application was refused. And the High Court held that the child of an EU national is only entitled to stay in the UK after Brexit if they're under 21 or dependent on their parent, and that this was in line with the withdrawal agreement. The next one is Upper Tribunal rules post-Brexit Zambrano appeals can continue. The case is Ojani Zambrano Transitional Appeal Rights Nigeria, and it was in the Upper Tribunal. Essentially, there is a distinction between appeals that were made before the 31st of December 2020 or are against decisions taken before that date, and appeals against decisions taken after the 31st of December 2020. As Colin puts it in the article, this is a highly technical decision, and so if you are in the situation where you are appealing a decision taken after the 31st of December 2020, then you definitely need to read it. In this case, the right of appeal was against a decision made before 31st of December 2020, and so it continues. The appeal continues until finally determined. Last, we have found some good news to end on, which we always try to do. This one is Home Office withdraws objective evidence test for trafficking decisions. So in January this year, the parts of the National Alien Borders Act that relate to trafficking were brought into force. New statutory guidance was published, and as a result of that, we saw that negative reasonable grounds decisions absolutely skyrocketed. Judicial review was brought by Duncan Lewis in relation to part of the new guidance, and the Home Office conceded the case. They have already published new modern slavery statutory guidance, and that no longer requires a potential victim of trafficking and modern slavery to produce objective evidence supporting their account in order to receive a positive reasonable grounds decision. I mean, how they were ever supposed to produce objective evidence of that is sort of beyond me. But it is good the Home Office didn't even seem to fight it. They just conceded. So essentially, they have abandoned the higher objective standard of proof that was introduced earlier this year for trafficking cases. And we'll hopefully see in the next statistics release for trafficking cases what impact that change has made on the number of negative reasonable grounds decisions. But this is definitely an important win and a good note to end the podcast on, I think.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sonia. I find this one a really interesting one because it begs the question of what the legal advice was, to my mind. It begs the question of what the legal advice was at the time that they were passing the legislation and so on. And then they just didn't seem to contest the case. Who was the lawyer who gave them the go ahead for doing this and sort of signed it off? And were their arguments so weak, you know, that they realized they didn't have a leg to stand on? So, yeah, something interesting going on with the sort of interaction between lawyers who are advising on what's possible in legislative terms and then actually thinking about sort of defending this in court.
We all want to know who's advising the government on this stuff, Colin. It's the $1 million question.
Yes. Well, I know, yeah, it probably costs them $1 million in costs when it comes to these sorts of things, doesn't it? Because things, yeah, roll over and end up conceding and paying everybody's costs. Okay, so that wraps up July. We're going to be back pretty soon with the August update. We're sorry that we're a bit behind. That's mainly my fault, I think, rather than Sonia's fault. But it has been the summer, so hopefully
we can share blame. Yeah, summer.
Oh well,
no one's been around.
Yeah, it has. Well, and finally, it's actually hot, isn't it? Anyway, right. So we're going to head off, and hopefully, that's been useful. We'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.